Chapter 17. Once the melon is a fool to refuse the rind, and I thanked the bishop for his kindness, and allowed him to give out that, my heart having been touched by grace, I had resolved, at the end of the season, to withdraw from the stage, and prepare to enter the church. I now fancied myself safe, for I knew the countess could not attempt my removal without risk of having her passion denounced to the duke. I spent several days very agreeably in the episcopal palace, entertained at his lordship's own table, and favored with private conversations during which he told me many curious and interesting things about the duke and the court, and delicately abstained from all allusion to my coming change of vocation. The countess, however, had not been idle. One day I received notice that the Holy Office disapproved of the appearance on the stage of a young man about to enter the church, and requested me to withdraw at once to the Barnabite Monastery, where I was to remain till I received the minor orders. Now the abbot of the Barnabites was the Belvert's brother, and I saw at once that to obey his order would place me in that lady's power. I again addressed myself to the bishop, but to my despair he declared himself unable to aid me farther, saying that he dared not offend the Holy Office, and that he had already run considerable risk in protecting me from the countess. I was accordingly transferred to the monastery, in spite of my own entreaties, and those of the good Tartaglia, who moved heaven and earth, to save his Columban from sequestration. You may imagine my despair. My fear of doing Tartaglia an injury kept me from revealing my sex, and for 24 hours I languished in my cell, refusing food and air, and resisting the repeated attempts of the good monks to alleviate my distress. At length, however, I bethought me that the countess would soon appear, and it flashed across me that the one person who could protect me from her was her brother. I at once sought an interview with the abbot, who received me with great indulgence. I explained to him that the distress I suffered was occasioned by the loss that my sequestration was causing my excellent manager, and begged him to use his influence to have me released from the monastery. The abbot listened attentively, and after a pause replied that there was but one person who could arrange the matter, and that was his sister, the Countess Belvert, whose well-known piety gave her considerable influence in such matters. I now saw that no alternative remained but to confess the truth, and with tears of agitation I avowed my sex, and threw myself on his mercy. I was not disappointed in the result. The abbot listened with the greatest benevolence to all the details of my adventure. He laughed heartily at his sister's delusion, but said I had done right in not undeceiving her, as her dread of ridicule might have led to unpleasant reprisals. He declared that for the present he could not on any account consent to let me out of his protection, but he promised, if I submitted myself implicitly to his guidance, not only to preserve me from the Belvert's machinations, but to ensure my reappearing on the stage within 2 days at the latest. Knowing him to be a very powerful personage, I thought it best to accept these conditions, which in any case it would have been difficult to resist, and the next day he informed me that the Holy Office had consented to the Signorina Miranda Malmaco's appearing on the stage of Pianura during the remainder of the season, in consideration of the financial injury caused to the manager of the company by the edifying conversion of her twin brother. In this way, the abbot was pleased to explain, you will be quite safe from my sister, who is a woman of the most unexceptionable morals, and at the same time you will not expose our excellent bishop to the charge of having been a party to a grave infraction of ecclesiastical discipline. My only condition, he added with a truly paternal smile, is that, after the Signorina Miranda's performance at the theater, her twin brother the Signor Mirandolino shall return every evening to the monastery. A condition which seems necessary to the preservation of our secret, and which I trust you will not regard as too onerous, in view of the service I have been happy enough to render you. It would have ill become me to dispute the excellent ecclesiastic's wishes, and Tartaglia and the rest of the company, having been sworn to secrecy, I reappeared that very evening in one of my favorite parts, and was afterward carried back to the monastery in the most private manner. The Signorina Malmaco's successes soon repaired the loss occasioned by her brother's withdrawal, and if any suspected their identity, all were interested to conceal their suspicions. Thus it came about that my visit to Pianura, having begun under the roof of a bishop, ended in a monastery of Barnabites, nor have I any cause to complain of the hospitality of either of my hosts. Odo, charmed by the vivacity with which this artless narrative was related, pressed Miranda to continue the history of her adventures. The actress laughingly protested that she must first refresh herself with one of the ices he had so handsomely provided, and meanwhile she begged the Count to favor them with a song. This gentleman, who seemed glad of any pretext for detaching himself from his elderly flame, rescued Mirandolina's lute from the inquisitive fingering of the monkey, and striking a few melancholy chords, sang the following words, which he said he had learned from a peasant of the Abruzzi. Flower of the time. She draws me as your fragrance draws the bees, she draws me as the cold moon draws the seas, and summer winter time. Flower of the broom. Like you she blossoms over dark abysses, and close to ruin bloom her sweetest kisses, and on the brink of doom. Flower of the rue. She wore you on her breast when first we met. I beg your blossom and I wear it, yet flower of regret. The song ended, the prima amorosa, overcome by what she visibly deemed an appeal to her feelings, declared with some agitation that the hour was late, and she must withdraw. Miranda wished the actress an affectionate good night, and asked the Count to light her to her room, which was on the farther side of the gallery surrounding the courtyard of the inn. Castelravinato complied with his usual air of resignation, and the door closing on the couple, Odo and Miranda found themselves alone. And now, said the good-natured girl, placing herself on the sofa and turning to her guest with a smile, if you will take a seat at my side I will gladly continue the history of my adventures. 2.9. Odo woke with a start. He had been trying to break down a great gold-barred gate, behind which Fulvia, pale and disordered, struggled in the clutch of the blind beggar of the Corpus Domini. He sat up and looked about him. The gate was still there. But as he gazed it resolved itself into his shuttered window, barred with wide lines of sunlight. It was day then. He sprang out of bed and flung open the shutters. Beneath him lay the piazza of Vercelli, bathed in the vertical brightness of a summer noon, and as he stared out on this inexorable scene, the clock over the hospital struck 12. 12 o'clock. And he had promised to meet Vivaldi at dawn behind the Emiliati. As the truth forced itself on Odo he dropped into a chair, and hid his face with a groan. He had failed them again, then and this time how cruelly and basely. He felt himself the victim of a conspiracy which in some occult manner was forever forcing him to outrage, and betray the two beings he most longed to serve. The idea of a conspiracy flashed a sudden light on his evening's diversion, and he sprang up with a cry. Yes. It was a plot, and any but a dolt must have traced the soprano's hand in this vulgar assault upon his senses. He choked with anger at the thought of having played the dupe, when two lives he cherished were staked upon his vigilance. To his furious summons Cantapresto presented a blank wall of ignorance. Yes, the cavalier had given orders that the carriage should be ready before daybreak. But who was authorized to wake the cavalier? After keeping the carriage 2 hours at the door Cantapresto had ventured to send it back to the stable, but the horses should instantly be put to, and within an hour they would be well forward on their journey. Meanwhile, should the barber be summoned at once? Or would the cavalier first refresh himself with an excellent cup of chocolate, prepared under Cantapresto's own supervision? Odo turned on him savagely. Tea traitor spy. in whose pay, but the words roused him to a fresh sense of peril. Canto presto, though he might have guessed Odo's intention, was not privy to his plan of rejoining Vivaldi and Fulvia, and it flashed across the young man that his self-betrayal must confirm the other's suspicions. His one hope of protecting his friends was to affect indifference to what had happened, and this was made easier by the reflection that Canto presto was after all but a tool in more powerful hands. To be spied on was so natural to an Italian of that day that the victim's instinct was rather to circumvent the spy than to denounce him. Odo dismissed Canto presto with the reply that he would give orders about the carriage later, desiring that meanwhile the soprano should purchase the handsomest set of filigree ornaments to be found in Vercelli, and carry them with the Cavalier Valsecca's compliments to the Signorina Melmacco. Having thus rid himself of observation, he dressed as rapidly as possible, trying the while to devise some means of tracing Vivaldi. But the longer he pondered the attempt, the more plainly he saw its futility. Vivaldi, doubtless from motives of prudence, had not named the friend with whom he and Fulvia were to take shelter, nor did Odo even know in what quarter of the city to seek them. To question the police was to risk their last chance of safety, and for the same reason he dared not inquire of the posting master whether any travelers had set out that morning for Lombardy. His natural activity of mind was hampered by a leaden sense of remissness. With what anguish of spirit must Vivaldi and Fulvia have awaited him in that hour of dawn behind the convent? What thoughts must have visited the girl's mind as day broadened, the city woke, and peril pressed on them with every voice and eye? And when at length they saw that he had failed them, which way did their hunted footsteps turn? Perhaps they dared not go back to the friend who had taken them in for the night. Perhaps even now they wandered through the streets, fearing arrest if they revealed themselves, by venturing to engage a carriage. At every turn of his thoughts, Odo was mocked by some vision of disaster, and an hour of perplexity yielded no happier expedient than that of repairing to the meeting place behind the Emiliati. It was a deserted lane with few passers, and after vainly questioning the blank wall of the convent and the gates of a sinister-looking almshouse that faced it, he retraced his steps to the inn. He spent a day of futile research and bitter thoughts, now straying forth in the hope of meeting Vivaldi, now hastening back to the Three Crowns on the chance that some message might await him. He dared not let his mind rest on what might have befallen his friends, yet the alternative of contemplating his own course was scarcely more endurable. Nightfall brought the conviction that the professor and Fulvia had passed beyond his reach. It was clear that if they were still in Vercelli, they did not mean to make their presence known to him, while in the event of their escape he was without means of tracing them farther. He knew indeed that their destination was Milan, but should they reach there safely, what hope was there of finding them in a city of strangers? By a stroke of folly he had cut himself off from all communication with them, and his misery was enhanced by the discovery of his weakness. He who had fed his fancy on high visions, cherishing in himself the latent patriot and hero, had been driven by a girl's caprice to break the first law of manliness and honor. The event had already justified her, and in a flash of self-contempt he saw himself as she no doubt beheld him, the fribble preying like a summer insect on the slow growths of difficult years. In bitterness of spirit he set out the next morning for Pianura. A half-melancholy interest drew him back to the scene of his lonely childhood, and he had started early in order to push on that night to Pontesordo. At Valsecca, the regular posting station between Vercelli and Pianura, he sent Canto presto forward to the capital, and in a stormy yellow twilight drove alone across the wasteland that dipped to the marshes. On his right the woods of the Dussel Chase hung black against the sky, and presently he saw ahead of him the old square keep, with a flight of swallows circling low about its walls. In the muddy farmyard a young man was belaboring a donkey laden with mulberry shoots. He stared for a moment at Odo's approach, and then sullenly returned to his task. Odo sprang out into the mud. Why do you beat the brute? Said he indignantly. The other turned a dull face on him, and he recognized his old enemy Gaianazzo. Gaianazzo, he cried, don't you know me? I am the Cavalier Valseca, whose ears you used to box when you were a lad. Must you always be pummeling something, that you can't let that poor brute alone at the end of its day's work? Gaianazzo, dropping his staff, stammered out that he craved His Excellency's pardon for not knowing him, but that as for the ass it was a stubborn devil, that would not have carried Jesus Christ without gibbing. The beast is tired and hungry, cried Odo, his old compassion for the sufferings of the farm animals suddenly reviving. How many hours have you worked it without rest or food? No more than I have worked myself, said Gaianazzo sulkily. And as for its being hungry, why should it fare better than its masters? Their words had called out of the house a lean bent woman, whose shriveled skin showed through the rents in her unbleached shift. At sight of Odo she pushed Gaianazzo aside and hurried forward, to ask how she might serve the gentleman. With supper and a bed, my good Philomena, said Odo, and she flung herself at his feet with a cry. Saints of heaven, that I should not have known His Excellency! But I am half blind with the fever, and who could have dreamed of such an honor? She clung to his knees in the mud, kissing his hands and calling down blessings on him. And as for you, Gaianazzo, you curd-faced fool, quick, see that His Excellency's horses are stabled, and go call your father from the cowhouse, while I prepare His Excellency's supper. And fetch me in a faggot, to light the fire in the bailiff's parlor. Odo followed her into the kitchen, where he had, so often crouched in a corner, to eat his polenta out of reach of her vigorous arm. The roof seemed lower and more smoke-blackened than ever, but the hearth was cold, and he noticed that no supper was laid. Philomena led him into the bailiff's parlor, where a mortal chill seized him. Cobwebs hung from the walls, the window panes were broken and caked with grime, and the few green twigs which Gaianazzo presently threw on the hearth poured a cloud of smoke into the cold, heavy air. There was a long delay, while supper was preparing, and when at length Philomena appeared, it was only to produce, with many excuses, a loaf of vetch bread, a bit of cheese and some dried quinces. There was nothing else in the house, she declared. Not so much as a bit of lard to make soup with, a handful of pastry or a flask of wine. In the old days, as His Excellency might remember, they had eaten a bit of meat on Sundays, and drunk aquarelle with their supper, but since the new taxes it was as much as the farmers could do to feed their cattle, without having a scrap to spare for themselves. Jacobin, she continued, was bent double with the rheumatism, and had not been able to drive a plow, or to work in the mulberries for over 2 years. He and the farm lad sat in the cow stables, when their work was over, for the sake of the heat, and she carried their black bread out there to them. A cold supper tasted better in a warm place, and as His Excellency knew, all the windows in the house were unglazed save in the bailiff's parlor. Her man would be in presently, to pay his duty to His Excellency. But he had grown dull-witted since the rheumatism took him, and His Excellency must not take it ill if his talk was a little childish. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.